of course, he bets on himself, and now he's just been out of this world. Now with 54, which is just outrageous. I mean, he's on pace for 65. I do think he'll slow down a little bit, but I think he beats the record. Like, I think he'll break Maris's record, wind up at 62.
Welcome back to the program. It's the Big Show in the Morning, live in hour number two. Hope you had a great Labor Day weekend and are feeling refreshed, recharged, and ready for the month ahead. My name is Matt Rose. Nick Alberga is my co-host, Patty Dumas, and Alex Brody running our show today, and very happy to go down the Atlas Pizza and Sports Bar guest hotline to talk to one of our favorites, our life insider. It is Adnan Virk. Adnan, good day, my friend. How was your long weekend?
Oh, it was great, Matty. Nick, good to be with you guys as always. It is the first day of school here in New Jersey. I'm assuming the same in Alberta, because go ahead.
Because
in Ontario, it was always the day after Labor Day, and in Connecticut, oddly, it was always 3 days before. I never quite understood the logic. School would start on Wednesday. You go to school Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, then you get a three-day weekend, and then you go from there, and I'm like, I don't understand. So you kind of get in a groove, and then you interrupt it right away. So I much prefer the Canadian way, and I'm assuming it's the same in Alberta, same as it was in Ontario, and I like the way here in Jersey. Day after Labor Day, let's get after it. By the way, rain today, so it's just a miserable day to drop your kids to school, but all good.
All in their nice fancy outfits going through all the rain puddles and stuff. That first day of school fit is just ruined. That's awful to hear. How are the kids handling
that? That's what it is, right? Some better than others. You know, my eldest used it's his first day of high school, so I'm like, all right, this is a big day. So I was more worried about him because this is like an early start now. He's got the bus coming at 7. And I was like, I remember missing the bus. I'm like, why don't I just go with you today? He's like, no, you're not going to go with me. I'm like, I'll just sit in the car because it's raining. And we'll sit in the car. Once the bus comes, you just step out. And he was like, nah. But then he was like, okay. And then one of his friends is waiting at the bus stop. And then I realized, because this is kind of embarrassing, if I was 14 years old and I had to sit with my dad in the car and I saw one of my friends standing there. So I'm like, all right, go ahead. But then I like a very overprotective father, I waited down the end of the street, couldn't see me, and made sure the bus picked him up. Then my 11-year-old first day of middle school, I don't know if they have this in Alberta. In Ontario, they did not. There's a separation between elementary school, kindergarten to 5, and then 6, 7, 8 is called middle school. That is a new phenomenon to me as a Canadian. But my son, Adine, is in his first year of middle school, which is grade 6. And then my son, Shaz, first year of kindergarten, which is a big day. And those guys were great. But my little guy, Moz, who I just dropped off, preschool, disaster. Just a disaster. And by the way, how about this? I don't know about you guys, Maddie and Nick, when you went to school, but I remember my parents, I think I had a binder, some foolscap, maybe a duotang, if you want to get very Canadian, some crayons, a pencil and pen, that's it. They give you a list of like 20 things to bring. It's crazy. Now, I get it. He's only 3 years old. We got diapers, that kind of stuff. But I'm like, you should have seen the image of me, Adnan Virk, TV superstar, lugging 2 paper bags, like giant bags, and Moz, who's crying, and I'm only like a blippy backpack. It was inevitable. One was going to tear, and it tore like 5 minutes in.
Like, oh, no problem, sir. We'll help you out with that. I'm like, oh, okay, I just look like a blumbling fool right now. And sorry, I'll pick up my my wet naps over here. They give you like 20 things, and it's so specific. It's not even a Ziploc bag. How about a quart Ziploc bag, and then sandwich Ziploc bags? Oh. Then we'd like paper towels given. I'm like, Jesus. I'm like, man. Isn't it like a school budget? Don't I pay taxes for this? You guys can just go get your own supplies. Come on.
You had all summer to get your own supplies. Like, come on, let's clean it up here at preschool and make things nice for all the kids there. You don't love that, that's for sure. For you, was it a busy kind of turnover going from the U.S. Open to first day of school? Like, that's quite the weekend.
Yeah, it's stressful, man. Like, think about when we were kids. I don't know about you guys, but I remember staying up late, and people go, oh, because you're so excited to go to school? And I go, no, I didn't want summer vacation to end. So I would wring every last morsel, and I think my parents eventually would say, okay, 10 o'clock in your room, but I would just stay up. I'm like, all right, because I want to make sure I savor all, 67 days of being up. But then, like most things in life, once I'm there, I'm enjoying it. Like, people have this misnotion about me. They think that I love to work. I'm like, no, if I have a choice of not working or working, I will gladly take not working. But every single day that I'm at work, I'm happy to be there, right? Like that's just the way I operate. But if given a choice of being slovenly and lazy, I will absolutely take those choices. So it was a really enjoyable summer for us. You know, hit the beach a bunch. And I, to me, summer is always a few things. Baseball, beach, barbecues. Had three barbecues, went to two Yankee games, and went to the beach like eight times. I'm like, all right. So like, and by the way, yesterday, a lot of watermelon. I go, I'm going to buy five watermelons because to me, that is truly summer. We're just going to crush some watermelon and just OD on the sugar. So it was really enjoyable from that perspective. To your question, Maddie, about the U.S. Open, I made sure that I went on Wednesday and I dragged two of my kids. My eldest son, Yusuf, he vetoed. He just said, no interest. Like, are you kidding? You've never been. He's like, I don't want to go. Dennis, I'm not interested. I'm like, you're 14 years old. Just go. No. Okay, fine. 11 and 5, those guys are getting more in the will. That's fine. Those guys listen to dad. They come with dad. Let's go. So U.S. Open, we went Wednesday. And here's the thing. I think I complained to you guys last time about this. When you go, you never know what matches you're going to get. So I just knew I was on Thursday night session. And I'm hoping for one of our girl Bianca or Ogier Aliassime, who I saw last year, against Tiafoe, coincidentally, who just pulled off this massive upset against Nadal, which was amazing, and Shapovalov. So instead I get Collins, the American. I go, are you kidding? I'm paying like $104 times three to go see some American. I'm like, hey. But a friend of mine said to me, no. He goes, get there at six. And there's always other matches going on. So I saw our boy Shapo on court 17, which is a fantastic court for the U.S. Open, and at least like a dozen Canadians. Like I had my Canada hat on, and then there was like guys with like the full Canada Maple Leaf jackets making noise and stuff. So it was like, ah, let's go, Shapo. So it was great. And it was fun to see Shapovalov. Unfortunately, obviously, he's no longer a part of the tournament, but I had to see him win that match. Then I went over and watched Collins. And, of course, our famous topic after we've discussed the price of food at Canada's Wonderland, U.S. Open, we're talking like a Pizza Hut pan pizza. It's not Pizza Hut, but like that size, maybe a little bigger. Let's take a guess on the prices, boys. How much for that at the U.S. Open?
Oh, boy. You go first, Nick.
I'll say $18.
Oh, man. I was going to say $15.50.
Okay, Nick's got to go buy a lottery ticket. It was $18 exactly. The
boom.
That is incredible. The margarita pizza, which is four small slices of pizza, $18. So, of course, I had two. Boys had one each. Wasn't nearly sufficient. So we're like, let's go get another one. I'm like, all right, let's times that by two. $36 for a little bit of pizza. All right, while Nick's on a hot streak, let's guess the price of a Coke. Large Coke. But you get the U.S. Open Cup. Of course, I'm always a fan of that concept. If it's a $7 Coke, no. If there's a cup involved, I'll get the cup. It was not $7. Guess how much with the U.S. Open Cup for large fountain Coke?
I will go $13.50.
I was going to go $11.
No, that's insane. Come on, $9.50. I was thrilled. Canadian prices would have been $13. But I said, thank God you didn't charge me $10. I couldn't sleep at night if I paid $10 for a Coke. But $9.50, I'm happy to do the heck I get a cup out of it. No problem at all. And then the ice cream, this is the last one. You guys will love this. So ice cream bar, think of like a Häagen-Dazs ice cream bar. I'm going to guess in Alberta, that's probably $3 at your local grocery store. Probably guess how much the price of that is.
I'm going to go $7 for that.
It was not Häagen-Dazs for the record. Yeah.
It was not Häagen-Dazs. It's just kind of like a generic name brand here that we're dealing with?
Yeah, correct. Okay. Maybe it's like a Breyers or something. I think Breyers is Canadian, but we'll call it Breyers. But
It wasn't Häagen-Dazs.
But it looked like a Häagen-Dazs.
Yeah. I'm going to say $9.50.
Well, pretty good guess. So let's split the difference here. $8.50. $8.50 for an ice cream bar.
Oh.
Times it by two. That's $17. And I look over my beloved boy Shaz, who's 5 years old. Just had a stunned look on his face after 5 minutes. He's holding just the wooden stick. And I go, wow, Shaz, you already finished it. And he points. And, of course, the ice cream bar is on the floor.
Oh, no.
but before, I just did not want him to have a meltdown. So I had to make sure I didn't react poorly. I'm like, it's okay, buddy. I'll go get you another one. He looked like he was on the verge of crying or getting angry. And then I asked, and he did neither, because I reacted. I'm like, no problem. At least no problem. Hey, that's $17 for one ice cream cone now, because one is on the floor. And I said, Shaz, were you gonna get mad or were you gonna cry? He's like, no, I was mad. I'm like, oh, don't worry. It's nothing to get mad about, buddy. Your dad is happy to pay $25.50 for three ice cream bars, which at most are $9 at our local grocery store. But bottom line is, Shapovalov wins U.S. Open. You gotta love it. Here's where I save the money, though. You guys be proud of me on this. I'm sure Calgary has a good public transit system. Somebody had said to me, do not park at the U.S. Open. Now, I've done it before. Last year, I had a couple of Canadian friends visit. As I mentioned, we saw Ogier Aliassime against Tiafoe. Ogier Aliassime won. And I parked at the U.S. Open. It was great. He goes, no, you can't do it. It's Dodgers-Mets. He said the Mets are – City Field is right next to the U.S. Open courts, the tennis courts, Billie Jean King. He goes, rush hour? He goes, I'm telling you, he goes, I drove Monday and it took me an hour just to park. Like an hour. Like there's cops there directing, it's a disaster. So I did pull off the veteran move of parking in Queens. You got to get street parking now. You can only use a New York City parking card. Of course, I don't have that. Or exact change. No problem. Let's figure out the math on this. $1.50 for an hour, but it was $4 for 2 hours. I stared dumbfounded and said, I'm not a smart man, but let's try that again. $1.50 for 1 hour, $4 for 2 hours. Okay, fine. Well, it's 5 o'clock and parking is free after seven, so whatever. Let's just roll. I go to the laundromat and I was like, hey, I just need some change. He's like, I can't help you. And I'm like, this is a laundromat. You absolutely have change. Like, there's no, I'm looking on the street. This is the one place I would expect to have change. I'm not expecting the Italian restaurant to help me. I'm expecting the laundromat. He goes, well, tell you what. He goes, I need the change too. I'm like, yeah, I'm trying to give you dimes and nickels for quarters. He's like, yeah, but that's useless to me. I'm like, okay, fair point. He's like, how about you just buy a roll of quarters? I can't remember the last time I bought a roll of quarters. But here's $10, $10 bill for a roll of quarters. Let's go put 16 quarters in that sucker. And then go hop on the subway, 61st and Woodside. You got to go up to Queens, but, you know, 8 stops, 30 minutes. But that's $2.75 for an adult, free for the kids. You just duck under that little turnstile, and you're good to go. So normally $30 U.S. Open parking. Hey, boys, we got away with $9 parking. Oh. Amazing. Loved it.
Dude, I'm exhausted by that. If that were me, I would just pack it up and go home and call it a long weekend and sit my ass on the couch and just watch TV. But that's just me. Serena Williams, man.
No,
like,
Nick.
What?
You're, yeah. Nick, you're right about the stress level at that point where I'm like, okay, what do I do? Like, where do I get a New York City parking car? That's not going to happen. And it's really hot. My kids are tired. By the way, and I think I had a radio hit in Toronto coming up. I'm like, what is going on right now? Which I ended up doing. Thank God I wasn't with you guys. I did the radio hit in Toronto. And, like, you can hear the 7 train just rumbling the entire time. Like, oh, like I said, Boba Shett has to step it up. just screaming about Boba Shett on the streets of Queens for no reason. People are just staring at, what is going on with this guy? I need exact change. Go ahead, Nick.
No worries. No, I just wanted to get your I love you, man. You bring the energy. We love that. Serena Williams, you speak of energy. What a career. What a legacy. What's your lasting memory of Serena? I just had that feeling she was going to do something special, and, well, yeah, she did.
Yeah, it's funny, Nick. I softened a little bit while I was watching her, and I kind of surprised myself. Initially, if you had asked me a month ago, I would have said, I think she's a poor sport. Like, I think she's an incredible player, but I'll never forget the fact that she told a line judge, I'm going to shove this ball down your mother effing throat. Like, I just, like, that is just such classless behavior. As you know, Federer is my guy. The reason I adore Federer is he just carries himself with such grace and comportment. And one of the great stories of Federer's life is he has a bad temper. And as a fellow guy with a bad temper, you never lose that. If you had a bad temper as a kid, you have it as an adult. You just learn to suppress it. And Federer's parents famously, his father says, this is a terrible story, but this should not be supported in today's day and age. But after losing it on the court, his dad, while driving him home, pulled him out and shoved his face first in the snow and was like, you are never going to be acting like that again, or you will not play tennis ever again. So, like, Roger Federer wants to get angry too, but he doesn't. Rafael Nadal, I'm sure, doesn't like some calls. He doesn't get mad. Novak Djokovic doesn't threaten line judges. So I've always had a little bit of a tough time with Serena. I have always admired her, of course. Her play is incredible. 23 majors speaks for itself. Fashion icon, the fact she's a black woman in a predominantly white sport who's been an enormous champion. I mean, it's awesome, of course. But I've always had that part like, I just don't like her personality. I don't think she's very dignified. And yet, while watching these matches, I could not have been pulling more for her just because who doesn't love the sentimental story of a GOAT, of a last champion with one last hurrah? And of course, like many, I couldn't get the Jimmy Connors 91 U.S. Open out of my head. Although, we can stop with that comp because he was 38, turning 39, and he went to the quarterfinals, where he then got dusted by Courier. Serena couldn't even get it to the second week. You know what I mean? Like, that first round match, the second set, she looked great. First set was wonky. That second match, though, was phenomenal. Like, I was riveted. Like, I was like, wow. Because the level of tennis was high. She played the number two player in the world in Kontaveit. And the fact that she won that second set, she lost the second set, looked terrible. And then came back the third set. I'm like, wow, Serena Magic is here. I never quite hopped on board with you, Nick. I never thought she'd win, but I at least thought, get to the second week. To me, that's just a major thing as a tennis fan. If you get to the second week, that means you're around to 16 quarters, et cetera, go from there. But I think what is ironic is the number two player in the world she beats, but then Tomjanovic, who is unseeded, plays the match of her life. Like, that was incredible how well she played and just was so undeterred. And in this match, Serena wins the first set, and then Tomjanovic was like a house on fire. I mean, just the way she just overwhelmed Serena. I don't think Serena was playing that badly. I just thought Tomjanovic raised her level of play. It just felt inevitable. So I was a little anticlimactic as a tennis fan to have it end on a Friday night. Like I said, only in the third round, but I did soften as I was watching her. So you know what? She's done a lot of great things. You can't hold one horrible incident against her. She's been, like I said, so inspiring to young women, to people of color. She's an incredible champion. That serve will go down, I mean, in history. That's the greatest weapon she ever had. The Serena serve is stuff of legend. So kudos to her, 23 Grand Slams. Although Margaret Court is a fascinating figure. I'm not sure if you follow this story. Margaret Court, of course, has 24 majors. But she is persona non grata in the tennis world because she has spoken out against gay marriage and, you know, same-sex marriage and all the rest. She's in Australia. Margaret Court came out yesterday and said, you know, Serena's never respected me. I've always respected her. She's never respected me. Now, I get it because of my, you know, religious beliefs and anti-gay marriage. People are, like, all sin against me. But, like, I was awesome. It was actually a really funny story. She's like, I won 24 majors. And, by the way, I think I'd be better today. She's like, we didn't have coaches back then. We didn't have first-class travel. We didn't have people pampering us. She's like, I won majors after I had kids. She was like, hello, Serena never won a major after having a kid. I won, like, six majors after having a kid. And anybody who thinks it was easier back then, I'm like, no, there was no support system. I popped at a kid, and I went and won the majors. So it was kind of funny, I think, for all this talk of Serena is the GOAT. Margaret Court is not going quietly into the night. She still has the most majors at 24 all time.
It's been fun to watch. Pretty good showing for the Canadians overall as well. I know no one is able to get past the third round, but what did you make of the five entrants?
Yeah, I think the good news is this, Maddie, is that, you know, I don't think people thought of us as a tennis nation up until 6-7 years ago, and now you can actually see this young talent starting to blossom. The concern becomes, and I kept thinking about this watching Jeannie Bouchard, 5'11", striking blonde with my buddy Steve Weissman on Tennis Channel. You know, 2014 feels like an eternity ago. Remember, she was in the final. You're like, wow, I can't believe a Canadian woman might win Wimbledon. And then since then, it's been a disaster. Like, I don't even know where she's ranked in the 300s. Like, she's been injured, inconsistent, focused more on modeling and other stuff. And I'm like, so I don't want to get too excited because I thought she would be the next great tennis hope for Canada. Like, just literally the best female tennis player ever. So I think with Andreescu, though, the good news is you see more competitive spirit. I don't mean to knock Jeannie. Maybe she'll come back and be strong one day. But at 28 in the tennis world, you're already pretty old. And with Andreescu, I think she just has more of a focus. And like I said, more of a competitive spirit. And it would have been nice to see BB go deeper. But I do like her mental game along with her, obviously, physical talent. She just has a ways to go to end up being in the top tier. Shapovalov, like I said, got to see him. He was fun. His lefty, who's fiery. He's seated 19th, but he feels better than that. Like, I know he's in top 20 players, nothing to sneeze at, but I feel like he's even better than that when he's rolling. He just had a really tough match against Rublev. That guy's the number 9 seed in the world for a reason. And amazing match. I mean, the fact they went to 5 sets, that's probably the best match I've seen so far. The level of tennis both those guys were playing, that was extraordinary. And an Oje Aliassime, probably a little bit of a disappointment this year, just because, like I said, last year you thought he could make a run, and this year kind of balanced out earlier. But, yeah, I mean, in the past, especially when you think about Canadians and other sports, like in golf, I was joking with my buddy McAuliffe, it was always Mike Weir and Calgary resident Stephen Ames. Like, anytime you were doing a highlight, you just had to get him in there. He'd be like, okay, Mike Weir is 7 shots off the pace. Here's Calgary resident Stephen Ames, 10 shots off. Oh, by the way, here's your leader, you know, just showing the rest of the field. But as Canadians, you want to support our own. Now you don't feel like if you're a tennis fan, you just have to placate us by including them in a highlight back. You know, they are actually legit, really good players. And John McEnroe, there's no better authority in the sport than him. He himself has said Canada's in a really good place with their young tennis players, and hopefully we'll have champions one day.
So, Adnan, as you know, it's September and things are starting to cook in the Major League Baseball world. Mm-hmm. What an afternoon. What a day yesterday for Bo Bichette. 3 bombs, 7 RBIs, 6 for 10. He was money in the bank, but I wanted to ask you about another team in the AL East that's been really sputtering the last month and a half. That's the New York Yankees, and more specifically, Aaron Judge, who now has 54 bombs. I just get the feeling that the Yanks have to go above and beyond in free agency. Like, is it your feeling that they're just going to have to find a way to re-sign this guy because he's putting himself in elite territory, and I start to wonder if – I don't know what that contract's going to look like. We know what he turned down, though, right?
Yeah, I mean, I live in Bergen County, which is the primary area where a lot of New Yorkers live when they're traveling to New York, obviously living in New Jersey here. And the two questions on the street right now for everybody who is a New York Yankees fan is, will he top Maris's record and will they re-sign him? And those are both part and parcel of the same question. And what he turned down was $213 million, which is a lot of cheddar. But even at the time, I was like, meh. I understand his point because it was 7 years and it was, you know, 30.9, I believe is the number. So maybe it's a little more than that, 31 point, whatever it was. But his point was, I want to get what the average value is. This goes back to the Soto argument, right? Everyone says, how can you turn down that kind of money from the Nationals? Well, if you look at AAV, average annual value, Soto is getting $30 million, which was only 14th best. He feels he's a top five player in baseball. That's why he's now a member of the Padres. For Judge, it's the exact same thing. I'm not getting 31. I'm getting 36. Trout gets 36. Garrett Cole gets 36.3. You know, I'm going to get that number. Tatis gets 34. That guy's been hurt, and now PED is like, come on, bro. I'm not getting 31. No way. And what holds against him is that they got him out of college. He's turning 30 this year. We all know contracts 30-plus don't age well, i.e. Pujols and Cabrera. But Judge will argue, hey, don't hold me to those guys. I started later than them. Now, the Yankees will argue, and this is why I think Cashman made the idea public, was that he's never played 162. Even now, right, load management is going to give him a day off here, and they're like, he's a big guy. Who knows how durable he is? So, of course, he bets on himself, and now he's just been out of this world. Now with 54, which is just outrageous. I mean, he's on pace for 65. I do think he'll slow down a little bit, but I think he beats the record. Like, I think he'll break Maris's record and wind up with 62, which will just be incredible drama right now down the stretch. He's been really hot lately. I think it's 5 homers last 13 games. So to answer your question, Nick, I think, listen, he wanted to bet on himself. He's going to get paid. John Heyman, who covers the Yankees for the New York Post, my friend and colleague from MLB Network, he put out 288, which feels pretty good to me because that's 8 times 36. So that made sense. 36 is the average annual value. Before they offered, I think, 7. Well, guess what? I balled out. I get an extra year now. Okay, now you're paying me until I'm 38. So you do the number 38 times 8. I believe that comes out to $288 million. Now, Joel Sherman, also a colleague and columnist in the New York Post, Joel Sherman thinks it's going to be a little bit more. Joel goes 304, I think the same amount of years. I think that we all agree that the Yankees are not going to give him a 10-year contract. Like, those days are gone. No one wants to pay a guy till he's 40. But he's going to get his money. So let's say minimum 288. Maybe Joel's right, 304. And the number was 213. So by having this out-of-world season, in which I believe he's going to break Roger Maris's American League home run record, which stood for over 60 years, he's going to make an extra $75 million. And if the Yankees don't pony up, I know everyone keeps saying the Dodgers, which is true, they will be involved, but don't discount the Mets. How much would Steve Cohen love to steal Judge away from across-town rivals? And the one I really think about is the San Francisco Giants. They're always a sleeping giant. They've got deep pockets. Farhan Zaidi hasn't spent big. Without Posey, they don't have a face of the franchise. They don't really have an identifying player. If I see any Major League Baseball team and I say what player comes to mind, you guys could do it really quickly. If I see the Giants, all of us would be like, I don't know, Brandon Crawford? Like Brandon Belt? Like, they don't have a signature star. They would love to have one. And where's Aaron Judge from? Northern California. So I think Yankees better pay up because I would watch out for the Dodgers, the Giants, and the Mets.
Adnan, one more for you, my friend. That's just on a little bit of film chat here. There was a screening of The Whale over the weekend. It's a new film that's coming out pretty quick, or might have released this weekend, actually. I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about the film and why Brendan Fraser getting a 6-minute standing ovation for his performance was so special.
Perfect question, Maddie. We're going to talk about today on Cinephile. I mentioned last week that my five for fall, five movies I'm really excited to see, The Whale is one of them, and the main reason why, before we get to Brendan Fraser, is it's directed by Darren Aronofsky. Now, he is a true hit-and-miss director. He will give you massive, massive films, which are so well done, like Requiem for a Dream or Mickey Rourke's comeback film, The Wrestler, or he'll give you just an absolute abomination like Mother, which is one of the worst movies I've ever seen, Jennifer Lawrence, Javier Bardem. Like, he's really hit-and-miss. So with Aronofsky, I'm always a little bit worried, but I see The Whale, and I go, okay, this sounds like something he can do. Comeback movie for an actor from the past. Just like Mickey Rourke in The Wrestler, he's going to resuscitate our man Fraser from The Mummy. So it opened at the Venice Film Festival. It's not opening stateside for a while. I don't know when the North America release date is. But with movies like that, you guys all know, they don't come out until like November, December, right when the Oscar balloting kicks up mid-January. So none of us are going to see The Whale anytime soon. But in Venice, it was a roaring, as you said, resounding 6-minute standing ovation. At one point, he tried to leave, but like was overcome with emotion and started crying. It's great news for the movie. It thoroughly announces him as a contender right now for Best Actor. To think we have Brendan Fraser up for a Best Actor award. Maybe he's the favorite right now. We still got 4 months until, like I said, the Oscar nominations even come out. But that's great news for the movie to get that kind of reception. I will caution with this, though. Sometimes at these film festivals, they have these crazy ovations, and then nothing happens. A film that I saw last year, and this is always tricky, I actually got to see it like a critic. I saw it like at a screening before the film opened. That movie is called Stillwater. Now, I love the film. I walked out and I go, that's one of the best pictures of the year. Matt Damon should get an Oscar nomination, even though it came out in July, which is hard for Oscar nominations to come out. He's that good in the movie. Stillwater premiered at the Cannes Film Festival in May. It got a standing ovation. I believe, look it up, a five-minute standing ovation for Matt Damon. And guess what? The movie came out. Nobody saw it at the box office. Matt Damon didn't get an Oscar nomination, just quietly went away. Now, I don't think that's going to happen with The Whale, but it's just to prove that sometimes these film festivals, these people do get a little excited. They get a little gaga, so to speak.
The video's great. He does like a little shucks, little kick at one point, and it's just pulled on my heartstrings. So it was good. We'll look forward to the next episode of Cinephile. Of course, with that now, we're going to be talking about the film. Thanks for the time today, my friend. I'm glad you made it through the first day of school and Labor Day and all that comes with it. And I look forward to our chat next week.
Thanks, Matty, Nick. Here's the big news, though. Now the kid's back in school. I may try to dial it up and go to the U.S. Open Wednesday without the kids, without having to buy $17 ice cream cones. So stay tuned if I can make a solo trip Wednesday day session back at the U.S. Open.
I'm on the edge of my seat already. Thanks, buddy.
Thanks, boys. Take care.
There you go. That's Adnan Virk joined us down the Atlas Beats and Sports Bar guest hotline. A 14-time Consumer Choice Award winner for takeout or delivery. Call 403-248-3344 or dine in Atlas Beats at 6060 Memorial Drive Northeast. What a great chat that was. We got to get out of here quick, though, because we're turning the page to a little discussion about the Dallas Stars. That around the corner. Sportsnet 960 The Fan. Welcome back. It's the big show in the morning. We are into hour number two. You can grab the show on your favorite podcatcher, Spotify, Apple, Google, Amazon, you name it, Kijiji. Yeah, we're on there. Sure, why not? The big show is what you look for. It might not have our names on it, but listen, it's the big show. It's got the Saddle Dome, the Calgary Tower on it. You'll see it. My name is Matt Rose. Nick Elberg is my co-host. Patty Dumas, Alex Brody helping us run the show today. And as customary in hour number two, the Atlas Pizza and Sports Bar guest hotline getting itself a workout. We go down once again to talk to Mike Hyka, the Stars writer from the Dallas Stars website. Good morning, Mike. How you doing? And as we're getting a little bit closer to hockey season here.
Very excited. It's been a long, hot summer down here, so get ready to get back to the rink.
Yeah, get back to those cool temperatures. Definitely, I can feel you there. There's been a lot of discussion around the Dallas Stars as they had a couple of very key restricted free agents going into the offseason, a couple of guys who did not have arbitration. So there wasn't necessarily a deadline for them to get signed. But nevertheless, the Stars are able to sign the 23-year-old goaltender, Jake Oettinger. He gets 3 years, $12 million total, so a $4 million AAV. Just what was your initial reaction to Oettinger getting this contract done with the Dallas Stars?
It's good for both, I think both sides. One, I mean, the Stars are up against a cap if they want to get Jason Robertson signed. So to get Oettinger at four is a good number for them. And then two, if they really, you know, want to commit to him long term, then this gives him 3 years to prove himself. And goalies are notoriously difficult to pin down. So, you know, having those 3 years will be good. And then the other thing for Jake is, you know, last year was his first real season. And, you know, he'll get a chance to, you know, to try and establish himself as one of the best goalies in the league. And the belief is that in 3 years, the Stars will be in a much better place cap-wise and that the cap may have gone up some. So I think he'll have a chance to cash in then.
Mike, it's Nick Elberger. Great to talk with you once again. It's amazing to me, as you know, that a year from, you know, last year at this time, I should say, you know, Oettinger was the four-string goalie for the Dallas Stars. What was it like to watch his season in real time go from sort of that four-stringer starting the year in the AHL to just dominating and, you know, putting Calgary at the brink of elimination there in Game 7?
Yeah, he's just an amazing mind, hockey mind. You know, we always talk about, you know, hockey smarts for players, people who can anticipate plays, people who understand the game. Jake's that guy. His ability to work, one. His ability as a great athlete, he's 6'5", 220. He looks like a tight end when he's out there. I mean, he's a very good athlete. And then he puts in the time, and then he handles all of the stuff that goes with being a goalie. So last year, I get what they were trying to do because of Ben Bishop. I think a lot of that, if you know, if you want to do the autopsy on it, I think Rick Bowness and Ben Bishop are incredibly tight. Good friends. They trust each other. And I think in a perfect world, Rick Bowness wanted Ben Bishop to be his goalie. And so then you do everything you can to give Ben, you know, the time to get himself up and running and to prove that, you know, he can play in the league again. But at the same point in time, you want to have a little bit of a backup. And so, you know, while that was going to be Khudobin and Jake, the fact that Braden Holtby was available, they thought, well, you know, we'll take a chance on this. And so that put Jake in a really bad spot and a difficult spot because he had played, you know, the year before and looked pretty good, looked like he was ready to be in the NHL. And so he had to go back down to the minors. He played only so-so down there, really. But when he got his opportunity to come up, he seized it. And, you know, there were injuries to Holtby. There were injuries to Khudobin. And obviously Ben couldn't play at all. So that helped him. But he also made it very easy for the coaching staff to say, look, we're going with Jake, and Jake is going to be our goalie who gets the most minutes. And to me, that's a lot, a 23-year-old, to just jump in the NHL and say, no, I'm the guy. And he carries himself that way, but he's not a difficult guy, if that makes any sense. I know some goalies who have that sort of confidence or cockiness can be difficult. Jake's not that way. He puts in the work. I mean, Jeff Reese, the goalie coach, just can't say enough good things about his work ethic and his mindset. So I think that's what we learned last year, is the fact that this guy has all of the tools and especially a great brain.
Where are things with Jason Robertson as far as getting that new contract done before the season begins?
I'm not really sure. I think there's two options, obviously, you know, a 3-year bridge deal, just like, or even two, just like Jake signed, or the 8-year deal. And the problem is that with Jake under, now they've got about 7.8 in cap space. And I'm not sure that 7.8 is, you know, what you want if you're going to be signing an 8-year deal. So I would say it tends towards a bridge deal. You know, I would go maybe even 2 years for Jake, just because, or for Jason, just because, I mean, I think the upside of whatever he gets is, you know, with the where contracts are going right now, you want to get to that place if you can. So if he were to sign a 2 or 3 year deal at like 7, that would fit obviously what their cap space is. I think it would be in that range of, you know, what players of his production have earned. So that's what I'm guessing. They're not saying one way or the other. Obviously, Jim Nill's very tight-lipped about all this stuff, tries to keep a lid on it. So I would guess, and like I said, I know 3 years is oftentimes the bridge deal. I might go for 2 if I'm Jason Robertson and, you know, knock it out of the park, get a couple more point-of-game seasons, and now you're talking big money. And again, you know, the league is changing. I do think the cap's going to go up, and the Stars clearly have some bigger contracts that are going to be off the books in 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, and I was going to say, unfortunately, I think the secret's out on Jason Robertson. For my money, one of the most underrated players in the NHL right now. 128 career games, 125 points, 58 goals. This guy's everything. I would argue he's the most important player to the Dallas Stars, what, just 3 years into his career. Another guy who doesn't get the love nationally that he does, Mike, is Roope Hintz, who is eligible for an extension right now. Is there any conversation around that, or do you think they're going to play this out a bit?
I would think they would probably play it out, although a lot is going to depend on what Robertson gets. You know, so much of this league is comparing yourself to other people on your team or across the league. I will say this, and I think it's an odd comparison, but the Cowboys learned that when they kept putting off Dak's contract, that it just kept going up and up and up. I mean, that's just the way of contracts. There's more money in pro sports. There's more money to be given to the players. So the more you delay this, it seems like the more the player wins. So if you're the Stars and you get Jason Robertson under contract and everything looks pretty good, then, yeah, I would start the discussions. I think that makes sense. You know, Roope's only real, criticism is he can be hurt. And so, you know, if he gets out and is not hurt and has great numbers, then that's going to help his cause. If he gets out and is hurt, then, you know, now all of a sudden you're like, okay, do we really want to give this guy an 8-year deal? You know, so we'll see. Again, Robertson's actually, you know, a pretty tall kid. He's gangly. He's not, you know, a great skater. But Roope is just a prototypical power forward. What is he? I think 6'4", you know, 210, 215. He might be the fastest or the quick. I'm going to say the quickest skater because he can cover small, you know, let's say, you know, 40 feet of ice in just no time flat. He has powerful legs, powerful stride. He's gotten good at face-offs. I mean, he really pretty much does everything you want a number one center to do. And he's really good defensively too. So, you know, if you're looking at guys who can go up against, you know, the other team's best center, then that's Roope Hintz. And to have that in a guy who can also, you know, help your line score, you know, that's amazing. Like, it's so funny. Stars fans criticize, you know, Rick Bowness and his coaching and, oh, it wasn't offensive enough and they didn't do this, they didn't do that. But that line, wow, they found a way to score. I mean, all three of them. So, you know, was that because of the coaching staff or is that just because they're so great and under a new coaching staff, will they even get, you know, bigger numbers? It's going to be interesting to watch.
We're talking to Mike Hyka. He's the senior staff writer for DallasStars.com here on the big show on Sportsnet 960 The Fan. This seems like an interesting year, Mike, in the sense that when you look at the roster, there is a lot of players who are only signed for one more season. A lot of money coming off the books next year. Is there a lot of players that you look at like the Hintz, maybe a Denis Gurionov or Joel Kiviranta, where you're looking at it and saying, this is your year to kind of take a spot on the Dallas Stars? Or maybe after this season, there's a lot of decisions to be made as far as maybe a different direction to look just when you look at how much money is going to come off the books in the next offseason.
Yeah, Jim Nill has done a good job. I he and I have a lot of discussions on this. I think it's hard to be both, to try and win the cup right now and build for the future, and that's kind of what he has tried to do. And, you know, when you look at, they got to the Stanley Cup Finals 2 years ago, and they're still developing Robertson and Haskinen and Hintz and, you know, some of these other younger players. You're like, okay, well, let's, you know, it's pretty good, you know, pretty good line of ascension. And now you look at the three kids who are coming from junior hockey, well, maybe coming, depending on, you know, if they can all make it. I think the fact that a couple of them have to go back to junior might make that more difficult. But Wyatt Johnston, Logan Stankoven, and Maverick Bork, you look at those three and think, okay, well, they're going to be in the lineup, right? So, yeah, I don't know about Hintz per se. And I think a guy like Joe Pavelski gets to kind of make his own decisions. He's on a one-year deal as well. But, yeah, guys like Gurionov, guys like Kiviranta, guys like Peterson, you know, you really need to show the team that when these new three kids come in, that you still have a place on the roster. So it will be very interesting. And then the other thing is and maybe this is more fan-driven than front office-driven, but they'd like another big name in the forward group. So, you know, they obviously were, you know, tossing around different names. And, you know, if Patrick Kane comes up, I think he's a guy they'd love to talk about. Now, I don't know if they have the cap space to do that. But if you can, and this is why I say on these contracts coming off the books, you know, yeah, you got to make room for Hintz's new deal. But, you know, if you can bring in the three young players on entry-level contracts and then still add a top-level, you know, top six forward, that would be something they'd like to do.
I have it on good authority, by the way. Not that I have a billion sources, but that Dallas has been sniffing around the last little while on Patrick Kane. But I think a lot of teams are going to be involved, certainly, in that conversation. Now, I wanted to time this question by somebody who ended up now with the Anaheim Ducks, but I'll ask it sort of two-pronged. Like, Miro Heiskanen, how does he get to that next level offensively? Because as a fantasy owner, we've been waiting for that. It's surprisingly enough, he hasn't hit the 50-point mark in his career. And what the hell happened with John Klingberg over the last 6 months and the fact that he was asking for X amount and X amount of years, and all of a sudden he sends a one-year deal with the Anaheim Ducks? Sort of stunning development there, Mike.
Yeah. I hate to criticize anybody on how things are done because, you know, at the time it seemed like the right move for his agent. But the fact that his agent took him all the way up to 29, and I think he's turned 30 already now, that was a bad decision. He should have cut that deal off at 27 or 28. And then John, I do believe, would have been one of the highest paid defensemen. But he went in to the Stars and wanted, I think, the 8-year deal at 29. And his, you know, numbers had been up and down. And so he couldn't get it. So then the other part is that because he signed that deal with them, I think he kind of had a little bit of a chip on his shoulder that he was underpaid. And, you know, I don't want to put thoughts into John's head or anything, but, you know, that's just the feedback you got is that, you know, he wanted to hit a home run because he'd already paid below his performance level for the past 3 years. And so all of that mixed together, I kind of thought for sure he'd go in and get a good deal. But I do think that he and his agent may have overshot his value in the league. And so then, you know, when all the chairs started moving around, there wasn't anything left for him. Because he's a very skilled right-handed defenseman, and he's played in a very conservative system. So it would be really interesting to see what he can do in a let-him-play system. So I'll be interested to see what he can do this year. And then the reason he did the one-year deal is because he thinks he deserves the money, that, you know, he'll go in there, he'll hit a home run, and he'll get the big money next year. And he'll only be 31. So, you know, but again, it's I just think that he was in a bad spot age-wise, and just it didn't work out for him. As for Miro, I'm with you. I actually think John leaving is good for Miro because, in my opinion, again, you hate to read into people's thoughts, but in my opinion, Miro steps aside. Miro lets other people do it if they want to do it. And John was a very aggressive personality. He wanted everything. He wanted to do everything. And so Miro said, okay, that's fine. You do everything. And I'll do what I can do. So it'll be interesting to see what he can do this year. He didn't even run the number one power play last year. He was second power play. Him running that power play, him being out there with Robertson and Hintz and Pavelski, I think will be a good thing. And then the other thing is, I do believe that Pete DeBoer and his coaching staff will tell him, look, you are our guy. You talked about Robertson being the most important player. I think Miro's the most important player. They're going to put in his head, we need you to do this. We need you to carry us. And I think Miro will slowly adapt to that, but he doesn't have what I perceive to be an aggressive personality. So it's going to have to be a process of him saying, okay, I have to do this, otherwise our team won't win. And that when you get into that spot, I think he'll be a top defense in the league.
Final one here for you, Mike. And it's just a thought on how the Stars will stack up in the Central Division with, you know, Alexander Radulov and Michael Raffel and Vladimir Mesnikov and John Klingberg all departing, a change at head coach with Pete DeBoer coming in, and then adding Colin Miller and Mason Marchment as free agents. How are the Stars going to stack up in a very competitive Central Division this year?
Well, I mean, I've looked at a lot. It's really hard to separate those 2, 3, 4, 5 teams, and maybe even 6 if Winnipeg, you know, can play the way that Rick thinks they can play. Well, that'd be 5, wouldn't it? Chicago but that's, to me, that's a tight group. I've seen people very excited about Nashville, and I just have seen them in the last couple of years as a team that's going to have to go into transition, but maybe that goalie is good enough to keep them right in the mix as well. But Minnesota, I think, is Minnesota. Now they're going to have to hit their, you know, cap limitations that were created by the buyouts. They didn't have it last year. I think they have it a lot heavier this year. St. Louis is really good. I just like St. Louis. I like how they play. I like what they do. Colorado, I think, is hands down the best team. And then Pete, in his history, has done a really good job of taking a team in its first year and really putting it all together. I keep going back to this. I said this at the end, and it's no slam on Rick or anybody else, but they were tossed together. That was just because of what happened with Jim Montgomery, that was not a coaching staff that you would draw up on paper. And so they did a great job, but at the same point in time, I think it's good for Rick to go someplace and be able to put his coaching staff together the way he wants to. And then it's good for the Stars that they get to come in with an entirely new coaching staff that seems, you know, to be a cohesive unit that has some history. So I believe the Stars will actually be in a really good place. I think Winnipeg will be in a better place. And I think it's going to be great. I think it's going to be great fun to watch these Central Division games.
Mike, really appreciate the time today. Looking forward to the season as well. Hopefully the Stars can get Robertson done. We can see the team at full force to start the season. That would be ideal, I think, for everybody. But really enjoyed the chat today. Enjoy the rest of your offseason, hey?
All right, thanks, guys. Always fun to talk.
There you go. That's Mike Hajka from the Dallas Stars website. Does a lot of writing for them over on the website. Covers the team. And that chat brought to you by Atlas Pizza and Sports Bar, 14-time Consumer Choice Award winner for takeout or delivery, 403-248-3344, or Atlas Pizza, 6060 Memorial Drive, Northeast. A good chat. Stars are an intriguing team, Nick.
Yeah, very. Like I like you said, I think there could be some change over the next couple of years. I think this is a massive year, goes without saying, for Jamie Benn and Tyler Seguin, especially with some of the kids coming. Like Mike referenced Logan Stankoven. That was actually one of my questions we didn't get to, but how legitimate of a chance does he have to make the opening night roster for Dallas? Because I thought he was incredible in the junior season, equally as impressive in the World Junior here in August. And I think he's knocking on the door, especially in this league. We talked about trying to compete now and trying to compete later. I think the more you can find a way to have these ELC sort of type players not making much on your cap, I think it takes you a long way, not to mention... again, it's been highly speculated that Dallas is sniffing around on Patrick Kane. I know a lot of teams are going to be involved in that conversation, but I do forecast a lot of change over the next little while when it comes to that roster as we see it. But the nucleus is set. Like it's Haskinen, it's Ottinger, foreseeable future, obviously, Jason Robertson, Roope Hintz. Like they got some really, really good pieces, but unfortunately, they're in a division that has the Colorado Avalanche and the Minnesota Wild for that matter, right?
Exactly. And for a team that really hasn't done a lot of high drafting over the last handful of years, they've done a pretty good job of shoring up their prospect pool while being a playoff team. Like it was just last week we were talking about it and we were like, well, I don't know if the Stars have that good of prospects. And you go look and you're like, well, I guess they did get Maverick Bourque, who was a beast in the QAQ this year, was really good at the Memorial Cup. He was a 30th overall selection in 2020. Wyatt Johnston was a 23rd overall pick the following year. He looks to be a stud as well. Ty Dellandrea kind of had a cup of coffee there with Dallas at the very end of the postseason and has played just a tad over the last couple of seasons, but he's a 13th overall pick from 2018. And then you've mentioned Logan Stankoven, who was dynamite at the World Juniors, a smaller player, skilled player, but you know, it was something I wanted to ask Mike about as well, and he kind of brought it up almost unprompted, that if any of these four guys can grab a spot and you're one of the guys who are on one of those one-year deals in your mid-20s, you got to be worried. You got to be panicking. Like, if you were slacking in this offseason and you're Denis Gurianov or Kiviranta or Peterson or Tanakiro or any of these guys who are kind of fringe players in for the Stars last season, you better give your head a shake, because this is a team that is going to be wanting to bring in these players who, A, probably better than you, and B, definitely cost less.
Internal competition is healthy. I'm very curious to see how Pete DeBoer does now that he's in Dallas. And again, it just speaks volumes to Jimmy Nill, right? Coming over from Detroit many years ago now, but still, the MO for Detroit back in the day, they never had high draft picks, you know, picking first, second, or third, but they always hit on their draft picks. And we're starting to see that. And the reason why Jim Nill, another offspring member of the Detroit Red Wings and the dynasty, right? Like, I think this was the expectation. And so far, I think he's exceeded mine as to what he's done as an NHL GM, not only prepping for the future, but also finding a way to get guys now. And that's why I think a serious team to watch for in the Patrick Kane sweepstakes is the Dallas Stars, in my opinion.
The thing for me with Patrick Kane is that their hole is on the blue line to me. I don't think the blue line is good enough to... go deep into the postseason in that Central Division in the West. Because, listen, we know what Klingberg was, and they replaced him with Colin Miller, who is, I would argue, almost an opposite style of defenseman, more of a shutdown guy than an offensive kind of themed guy. I know he had a couple of offensive years when he was in Vegas, but you know, in Buffalo, he's definitely become more of a shutdown guy. Ryan Suter's 37. Esa Lindell is more of a shutdown guy. Hackenpah's a third pair defenseman, and then you got Thomas Harley, who you hope can make the jump, but it, but to what extent, right? So I've got some questions about the blue line. That's the one thing I look at.
Yeah. No, that's fair. I think we're really going to find out what Miro Heiskanen's made of this year. I think there is some stability with the veteran Ryan Suter there. Esa Lindell's coming off a phenomenal year. And I'll tell you right now, maybe more so because my buddy coached him, but don't sleep on Thomas Harley, who's a former first rounder. Got his feet wet last year, and I would not be shocked at season's end if he's fully entrenched in the top four there in Dallas. So I think you're right. It's always, you always have to pump the brakes, especially when it comes to young defensemen, because it does take longer, but there is severe potential there. But you're right. A lot can be masked with Jake Oettinger, especially his second half of the season. Dude, he was phenomenal and almost single-handedly beat the Calgary Flames, right?
Yo, 100%. And Thomas Harley's another guy like I was talking about, an 18th overall pick in 2019. You miss the playoffs, but you get a player that, you know, not immediately, but a couple years later is a surefire NHLer. And yeah, 21 years old. You really like what you're seeing from Harley, who 6'3", like that's a big defenseman. You just hope he can take a few steps forward this year. We'll take a break. That was another guest down the Atlas Pizza and Sports Bar guest hotline. We're going back down it once again. Our pal, Kevin Woodley from In Goal Magazine, going to talk a little bit of JT Miller. Going to talk a little bit of Thatcher Demko. We can ask him about Jake Oettinger. And I also want to ask him about Pete DeBoer, because he does everything goaltending for In Goal Magazine, but he also covers the Canucks for NHL.com. We'll get into it with Kevin Woodley around the corner. Sportsnet 960 The Fan.